Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation system helps stop opioid misuse before it starts. With DoTerra, unused prescription opioids and other drugs are gone for good. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. With this podcast, I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this bonus episode of Inside Crime. With the big verdict out of New York City in the highly publicized trial of notorious drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, I wanted to bring you the inside story about the hunt for the elusive fugitive. My guest today is with DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and he played a key role in the capture of El Chapo. He'll reveal what it was like behind the scenes, hunting down the world's most wanted drug trafficker. And we'll hear what El Chapo's conviction means to the current opioid epidemic and how that impacts your community. Special Agent in Charge Ray Donovan is the new head of DEA's New York Field Division. Prior to taking over the helm in New York City, Ray was in charge of SOD, the Special Operations Division at DEA in Virginia. SOD brings together an elite team of law enforcement from multiple agencies. United, they have one mission: to bring down major drug trafficking organizations around the world. It was the nucleus, the epicenter, for the biggest manhunt ever conducted by the DEA.
El Chapo is the leader of the Sinaloa Mexican cartel, thought to be responsible for a quarter of the drugs here in the U.S. Marijuana, cocaine, heroin, meth.
A man so rich he's made the Forbes billionaire list, and so powerful, officials tell ABC News, he's responsible for tens of thousands of deaths by overdoses or murders.
One Mexican official says he's their Bin Laden, the world's most powerful drug lord with the blood of countless people on his hands.
Welcome to Inside Crime, my friend, the famous Ray Donovan.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Angeline. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to be here in New York City.
Yes, it is. It's home. It's one-of-a-kind city. No place like New York City.
What's it like to be back here in New York running the show here for DEA?
It's exciting. I am happy to be home. It's a place that I grew up with. A lot of challenges, but there's a lot of opportunities for us to do some good for New York City and really for the tri-state area as well.
So I want to talk to you about your plans and your vision as the new boss here. Mm-hmm. But we have to start out by talking about, you know, the big trial, the highly publicized trial. Everybody's talking about it. Yes.
Sure. El Chapo. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, is it a surprise to you that there's so much fascination with this trial?
No, to me, it's not really surprising. When you have someone the magnitude of Joaquin Guzman, who's been this image of the highest level crime boss in the world for so many years, and then actually have him extradited to New York City, behind that, there's going to be a lot of fascination, a lot of questions of how he got to rise through the ranks of Sinaloa cartel and then take over the cartel. And then how did we actually get him here to New York?
What's your reaction to the verdict?
It sends a message to every other drug trafficker in the world that if we can get our hands on Chapo Guzman, bring him here to the United States, and then prosecute him and then find him guilty, I think the message is very loud and clear that we can get anyone. He's really caused so much hurt and pain throughout our communities, throughout the United States, and really because of all the drug that he's pushed into the United States and into New York.
It's a good point. I think people think, oh, you know, that was in Mexico or that's somewhere else. What does that have to do with me?
If you look at what's going on right now across the United States, we have the opioid crisis. Chapo Guzman, being the head of Sinaloa cartel, was very much instrumental in pushing fentanyl and heroin that is killing our kids across America. He was one of the people behind that. You go back as far as 2011, 2012, when we first started seeing fentanyl come into our communities. It was Sinaloa, and it was Chapo and his sons and other members of the Sinaloa cartel. And the reason why they did that was to make their heroin stronger at first, because the Mexican heroin wasn't as potent. Mm-hmm. And so they added fentanyl to it. And subsequently, from 2011 till now, we see a lot more pure fentanyl coming into the United States.
For people who may not even know, what's the Sinaloa cartel?
It is an organized criminal network based in the states of Sinaloa. However, they do control many other Mexican states, but Sinaloa is their hub. In particular, Culiacan is the city. But it's an organized crime group that is engaged in drug trafficking and human trafficking and gun running and a whole host of different criminality. It's one of the most powerful criminal groups in the world. They control some of the bigger cities for distribution of illicit narcotics. So illicit narcotics would be cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, heroin, fentanyl.
Let's talk about why this conviction is so important.
When you look at Chapo Guzman, we see him as the man behind the curtain. He's sort of like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
He's the one who established the transportation routes, the distribution routes. He sent billions and billions of dollars worth of illicit narcotics to the United States. The opioid crisis right now is at the forefront. It's our number one problem that we see in the DEA. It is what I think about every single night. How am I going to fix that? And so when I think about the conviction of Chapo, it sends a message to every other drug trafficker in the world that we won't stop until we get you.
How would you describe Chapo compared to any other drug trafficker?
In Chapo's mind, he ruled with an iron fist. Okay, in his mind, he saw any kindness as weakness. And so what does that mean? That means he was extremely violent. His organization was extremely violent. I honestly believe that the Sinaloa cartel, in terms of how violent they were, I compared them to ISIS. And really, ISIS has nothing on the Sinaloa cartel. And to this day, Chapo was a man behind that and fighting other criminal groups for control of the border, really, because that's where a lot of that violence comes in. Controlling the routes into the United States, the drug routes, the smuggling routes, is really where a lot of violence in Mexico stems from.
When people think about the capture of El Chapo, we have to remind them that he was captured and then escaped and recaptured. Right?
That's correct.
And you were there for all of that.
Yes, that's correct. In 2012, I arrived to the Special Operations Division, and immediately my goal was to really take a deeper dive into the Sinaloa cartel and see if there was an opportunity for myself working in conjunction with other agents and agencies to not only pursue Chapo, but pursue Ismael Miles Zambada, Rafael Caro Quintero, the other heads of the cartel as well. And so that's where it kind of started. It stemmed from there. But one of the things that I would say is that although DEA led it, it was certainly a collaborative effort of many different agencies. In fact, there were about 22 agencies that played a significant role in pursuing Chapo Guzman.
Yeah, that's important to mention because so many people had a hand in this.
Sure. And one of the things that I would also stress, and I can't stress it enough, was the fact that our Mexican partners were right there in the middle of it. They agreed to pursue Chapo. And really, when you think about who's really putting their lives on the line, it was the Mexican Marines. After about a year and change of us doing the background, the development, you know, looking for key nodes, key individuals, key players that support Chapo. Eventually, we get to the point where we feel pretty comfortable or we have an idea of where Chapo is, where he's located in Culiacan, Mexico. We're starting to get everything ready. And when I say everything, the personnel, the people, the Mexican Marines, we're trying to
establish the logistics. Because you have the information now.
Sure, we have all the information, but we're trying to get prepared to launch an operation.
Yeah.
We finally got to that point in January 2014. But what people may not be aware of is that we were also launching an operation to go after Ismael Miles Zambada.
And who is that?
Ismael Miles Zambada is the other head of the Sinaloa cartel. In partnership with Chapo Guzman, Mayo is also a very powerful cartel boss. Really, he is, along with Chapo, one of the strong leaders of the organization. And so when we were prepared to launch the operation, our goal was to not only go after Chapo, but to go after Miles Zambada. So on January 20th, 2014, we were ready. We had all the Marines on ground. They were in La Paz, Mexico. And they were ready to go launch the operation to go on Mayo. And we did. We found a ranch in outside of Culiacan where we believe Miles Zambada was located at. So the Marines launched the operation to go grab him, and they just missed him.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, they just missed him. He went up to the mountains of Sinaloa. We started looking for Chapo Guzman. But we knew that Chapo was going south of Culiacan every 2 weeks. He had a place that we coined the Duck Dynasty. It was a swamp. Yeah, it was a swamp area where he would go down and relax. A couple of huts, a couple of houses, where every couple of weeks he would go down there and just kind of hang out. But it was isolated, and it was perfect for us to go and try to grab him with minimal force, and it would be ideal. But we never had the opportunity. Chapo stayed in Culiacan. He stayed in the city. Started calling in for reinforcements, more security people, weapons, armed vehicles. He knew that we were there.
Getting closer.
Yeah. He knew that we were there. On February 17th, we go and try to zero in on Chapo. We find the location where we believe he is at. And the Marines start to try to make entry into the location. It was a steel-reinforced door. They finally made entry into the location. Every room had closed-circuit TVs in it, so he had security cameras in every room looking at the front of this house. So he knew that we were coming. And in the bathroom below the tub, there was an escape hatch that went down into the sewage system. So as the Marines made entry into the location, they went into the bathroom, and they see that the tub was lifted up.
As you describe this, I can see the picture of the bathtub kind of lifted up there, and sure. It was just so incredible.
Sure. I mean, it's a great escape hatch, right? But he also had it in every one of his safe houses. He's always had a way out. But when you think about this operation, he knows that we're in Culiacan. He knows that we already went to get Mayo, but he stays put because he was very confident in his preparation. He had the steel doors, he had the TV, he had multiple safe houses that were all connected under the sewage system.
So on your end, you're like, we were so close.
On our end, we were like, okay, well, that was it. I don't know if we're going to get that again.
Yeah.
I just didn't know. We didn't know if we were going to have the same opportunity. So several days later, we realized he was down in Mazatlan. We didn't quite know where yet. We knew that he had moved. I pretty much pushed a lot of those guys, our team that was there alongside the Marines. I asked them to get down there and said, okay, this guy's left Culiacan. There's no question. You need to shift down there. And they did. And that was the Marshals, HSI, and us, DEA. So eventually they get down there. And lo and behold, we're starting to zero in on them again. The Marines are down there now. Our people are down there. We zero in on a Miramar hotel.
You're feeling pretty lucky because this is only a matter of days.
This was days later. That's what happened on February 22nd, 2014 at the Miramar hotel. We knew he was there. We just didn't know what room. Mm-hmm. And so the Marines started going from the top floor down. Eventually, they found him on the fourth floor. They went in the door. Chapo went to the bathroom. And they were screaming, and he gave up.
It was a stunning sight. The most powerful drug lord in the world in handcuffs after more than a decade as a wanted man.
An elite unit of Mexican Marines burst into this apartment in Mazatlan, Mexico. They find the world's most wanted drug lord, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, lying shirtless next to his beauty queen wife.
Well, for Mexico and for people fighting in the war on drugs, this is huge. This is as big as it gets.
After eluding authorities for years, one of the world's most wanted drug lords is behind bars.
His arrest tonight being called the biggest setback to the drug trade in three decades.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like on your end when you get the word? How does that come down to you guys?
So everyone felt extremely accomplished. It was a good thing. It was a good feeling to know that all the hard work paid off.
And I'm thinking, you never in your wildest dreams would think that he would escape a year or so later, right?
No, not at all. I mean, it didn't even come to my mind.
No. Why would it?
It didn't even come to my mind.
Let me just ask you, how did you learn the news that he had escaped? Do you remember?
I do.
So where were you? And take me back to that.
Okay, it was about 5:30 in the morning, and my wife was nudging me to get up. And that's early for me. but she was nudging me to get up because my phone kept on going off. And so I got up and I immediately checked my phone, and I had like five messages saying, telling me from agents in Mexico and agents in headquarters that Chapo had escaped. I put the news on immediately in total disbelief. Realized, I thought, at first, my wife told me, and then I didn't believe it.
So you're saying to yourself, no way,
no
what are
way.
You talking about?
He's in Altiplano prison. It's their strongest prison. There's no way he can get out of there. No one's thinking about his escape. At this point, we're trying to figure out how we can extradite him back to the United States. So let alone Chapo actually escaping. It was total disbelief.
Tonight, the top drug dealer in the world has done it again, his legend and infamy growing as he escapes a maximum security prison for a second time.
It was another elaborate getaway, with one of the world's most powerful drug lords slipping out of Mexico's most secure penitentiary and emerging from a tunnel in this partially built home just 1 mile away.
Guzman vanished from the shower near his prison cell. Prison officials found a tunnel underneath. He traveled underground for nearly a mile before reaching the surface at a construction site.
This time, his escape is the stuff of movies. Slipping through a small hole in his cell and into a tunnel, complete with ventilation, lights, and a motorcycle on rails, apparently used to help dig him out.
And at this point, you still don't realize how he escaped, right? Or, I mean, you guys have an idea, I guess.
Well, we didn't really know. We didn't know the method. We later found out that we had more information than we knew we had. Okay, once we started putting all the pieces of the puzzle together, we realized this was happening somewhat in front of us. But we didn't know that this particular investigation was connected to another investigation, which was connected to another investigation. When we put it all together, we see how he was able to escape. The day when we caught Chapo, I honestly believe that's the day that he was deciding that he was going to escape. He already had escaped from prison before that, and so he had plans to do that. We just didn't believe that he could do it out of Altiplano. If you think about it, it's really a tremendous feat to build a tunnel directly to his cell, you know, over 1 mile long.
Yeah, so refresh our memories. How did he actually escape? Tell us what the setup was.
You had many people coming to visit him to pass messages back and forth between himself, his family, his organization, his attorneys passing information. But they also were passing the plans. It wasn't only information and direction from Chapo. It was also plans of escape. How they were able to do it was they had a team of diggers, engineers, dig in this tunnel for, we estimate, around 10 months directly to his cell and right up into his shower stall to get him out. Now, when he did escape, it was...
I can't help but laugh because it sounds like a crazy movie.
Well, I mean, it is. It does sound like a crazy movie. I mean, it sounds unreal, but if you have the resources, you have the money, and you have people willing to achieve this, then it's really just a matter of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he had. They had purchased the land outside of the prison. He had a cell phone in the prison. Cell phone had GPS coordinates on it, and they were able to zero in on the GPS coordinates.
So they would be able to dig exactly to his location.
Where he is, sure.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I remember the mood in the room. We all looked at each other like, it's unbelievable. Because here it is, we go from, we captured arguably the most notorious crime boss in the world, and it's a tremendous feat, and now here he is, he escaped. Once we identified the key players that were associated with his escape, our friends, the Mexican counterparts that we work so closely with, were able to really put the escape conspiracy together. They were able to paint a picture of how it all happened.
Mm-hmm.
That night in July 2015, when he did escape, he rode a motorcycle out of the tunnel and he got onto ATVs and he took ATVs up to an airport. And in the airport, there were two planes there. One plane was a decoy plane and the other plane flew him into Sinaloa that night. And
yeah.
So from there, he went up to the mountains of Sinaloa.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was on the run. And that night, when Chapo went up into the mountains, we were already figuring out how we were going to go get him again.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take?
It took us about 3 weeks before we were zeroed back in on Chapo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got to understand something about the area that he was hunkered down at. It's the Sierra Madre Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just drive up to the mountains. Or you can't take a motorcycle or you can't take, you know, an yeah. ATV up to the mountains. These are really difficult terrain to try to get to. And so he did that on purpose. It protects him. And so the only way in is through helicopter. He had many security guards around him. We counted over 40. And there was other people there too, women, there were some children. So he was in a camp, if you will, that had numerous buildings.
I mean, I know there's things you can't talk about, obviously, and things you can't, but you know, we're interested in the things that you can talk about.
So his escape was in July 11, 2015. So we were going to launch on October 2nd. There was a storm. And one of the things that we would do is we want to make sure that we have the best visibility going into an operation like this. Because when you have over 40 security people that are fully armed, there may be a gun battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so it certainly concerned us. And together we decided we have to push this back because Chapo had already left the ranch. And so now we go from a controlled area to a not controlled area that we're not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the difference.
Right. How was he living during this time?
He lived like a man who was on the run. Wherever Chapo was hiding out, he had a go bag. And the go bag is really just a bag of supplies, radios, phone, some money, weapons, food. Just in case he can make a quick exit and be able to go to the next location. And so it was no different in the ranch that we located him at up in Cosolo. It wasn't a lavish ranch. It wasn't, you know, state of the art. It was normal. He had numerous safe houses where he can go throughout the city and move from place to place through the sewage system.
And so when it was finally that day, what was it like on your end?
When we launched the operation to go capture Chapo, we missed him. So the Mexican Marines launched the operation. They went in to go grab Chapo, and Chapo was able to evade us for several weeks up in the mountains. They put a 15-mile perimeter around him, and he was running. Him and several security people were on the run for 2 weeks, and he was able to get around the perimeter. And he started running back towards his birthplace, La Tuna, Mexico. And then at that point, and so this is around October 2015, the Mexican Marines did a really smart thing, and it was their idea. They said, well, we're going to put pressure on him. And he started putting pressure to force Chapo out of the mountains. And that was their plan. At the same time, we knew about a potential safe house in Los Mochis, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't 100% certain that Chapo was going to use it, but we had certain indicators. So around the clock, they're watching the safe house 24 hours a day for weeks. So early January 2016, we're starting to get information that Chapo is going to move.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we didn't know 100% if he was going to go to the city or if he had some other safe haven or some other location. But we were ready for him down in Los Mochis.
Mm-hmm. You're waiting for him to move.
Sure. So around January 7th, the Marines, the Mexican Marines, were in Los Mochis and they saw Chapo. But he also had plenty of security people with him that were armed.
And what's it like on your end?
On our
back
end,
at SOD, what are you guys
on our
saying?
End, we are, at this point, we're glad that we have visibility on him, meaning we put eyes on him. So we know we're going to have another shot at capturing him at that point. And we see him go from one truck to another truck in Los Mochis. And they drive him to the safe house that we already knew about. We also had an idea that there would be an escape hatch somewhere in that house going into the sewer. So we zeroed in on him. Eventually, the Marines launched the operation to go capture him.
You're listening to the actual gun battle, all recorded by helmet cam of the Mexican Marines. When the smoke cleared, five of Chapo's security team had been killed, and six others were captured, but Chapo was gone. Once again, he escaped through the sewer system. When he popped out of a manhole on the streets of Los Mochis, Chapo then carjacked two different drivers to get away. But the second car stalled, and the Marines were moving in quickly.
And now the Marines, they're looking for him. But they started getting information on the radios down there about what happened. So once they got that, they zeroed in on the location. The Marines identified the second car that was carjacked. It was up on the tow truck. Tow truck driver says they went into this motel, points to the motel.
The drug lord known as El Chapo was captured today, 6 months after he broke out of a Mexican prison for the second time.
Mexican President Peña Nieto announced El Chapo's capture on Twitter, saying, "Mission accomplished, we have him."
Mexican officials say the drug lord had a lot of firepower near him. Captured in the raid, a rocket launcher, 8 rifles, 2 armored vehicles. At least one analyst surprised he was taken alive.
That was a great day then.
Sure. That was a great day. That's still only the beginning. Okay, we caught him. He already escaped once. What's going to happen next? He went right back to the same prison, Altiplano.
The prison that he escaped from.
That's correct.
And you're thinking to yourself, what the heck?
Well, we're worried. Although it's a new staff there, new administration there, you know, if he already did it once, can he do it again?
He could.
Yeah, certainly. And so we're concerned. We're voicing our opinion. So they moved Chapo to another prison. We did a good job of capturing him twice. But now the real work is, how are we going to get him out of Mexico? This guy has the people, the resources, the financial resources, to escape from a prison, the strongest prison in Mexico. And so the Mexican government did the right thing. In so many ways, they did the right thing. They did the right thing in partnering up with us, but they also did the right thing in extraditing him out.
Right. Because for a while, we didn't know where he was going to go, if he were to be extradited, right? Whether Chicago, New York.
We didn't know that we would physically get him to the United States. So to have the Mexican government partner up with us and actually extradite him was a big win.
Big deal.
Big deal. The extradition was just as important and just as big of a deal as the capture was.
Right. And so to think that there's a conviction now after all of that, I mean, this is a big deal anyway, but for you personally, it's got to mean so much more because you were such a key player in bringing him to this point all of these years.
For me, it was very important, but it wasn't just me. It was the team of people that were engaged with this, that dedicated their time and energies, everything towards this effort. And when I said there was 22 agencies involved, there were, but there was also hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of people from that time in 2012 all the way up till today. Some people may ask, well, why was that important? I would say very clearly, to all the victims of heroin, fentanyl, overdoses, and deaths, and it's important to their families, and it's important to our communities. He was the brains behind fentanyl. and mixing it with heroin and sending it into the United States. So all those deaths, this is it. We got him. He's convicted. And now he's going to serve the rest of his life in jail.
When you say he was the brains behind this all, obviously there's still more issues. And sure. The problem has exploded.
It is what keeps me up at night here as a SAC of New York. It is. It is fentanyl. It's such a deadly drug. It's synthetic. It's made in a lab. It's accessible. But there's two ways it's coming in to the United States and New York. It's either coming in through Southwest border, or it's coming in because people are going on the internet and they're going on a dark web to order it up and have it shipped. But more and more, we're seeing larger shipments of pure fentanyl go into Central America, into Mexico, and it's smuggled across our border.
I know there's no one answer, right? And it's just not that simple. You say it keeps you up at night, and you have a big job ahead of you now as the new head of DEA here in New York City. Can you share with us some of your thoughts about the direction?
I think one of the solutions as far as getting ahead of the fentanyl issue is working closely with China. The vast majority of fentanyl is produced, manufactured in chemical factories throughout China. And then it is shipped to Mexico or shipped directly into places like Canada or even here in the United States. I think working with our counterparts to try to regulate all variations of fentanyl is important, and I believe that China is headed in that direction. That will be a game changer for us. Mm-hmm. The other concern with China is really just precursor chemicals. That would be an area where we can work a lot closer with them to slow the stem of illicit precursor chemicals headed to those locations that are going to be utilized to manufacture methamphetamine. When you look at what's going on in New York City and you look at the heroin and fentanyl overdoses, they go hand in hand. You can't work the street level or the mid-level traffickers without working a higher level.
When we were talking about prevention and making people more aware of a problem, that is part of the strategy to get the word out that it is dangerous, because when it's dangerous for one segment of the population, that affects everybody.
Sure, right? It affects all of us. It is not only about law enforcement. It's about education, prevention. It is about treatment. But it's all of that done together. You can't do one without the other. And I think that's important. It's about getting to our kids and letting them know that, hey, this is deadly. And this will affect you and affect your lives.
It's just so nice to talk to you, Ray. Whenever I talk to you, I can sense that there's true passion in what you do and how you feel about this job. I just want to talk to you about how this all started for you. When you were growing up, did you know you wanted to be a DEA agent? Or tell me a little bit about your background.
So I grew up in the Bronx, in the Kingsbridge area. But I lived in Manhattan. I lived in the Bronx, obviously, but I also lived in Queens. For me, I didn't know what I was going to do or be until college, until I went to St. John's University. And I was initially going to St. John's as a pharmacy major.
Really?
Yeah, I figured it would be a good job, and it's interesting. But early on, I took a criminal justice class. And in that class, there was a DEA agent that came and spoke. He came and lectured us and talked about the job and what it meant, and gave a real inside picture of, you know, what they do. And I knew upon hearing that lecture that I was going to be a DEA agent. I didn't know how, when. I didn't know.
He impacted you that much?
It certainly did. It changed the course of my life, because growing up, I knew I always wanted to give back. I knew I always wanted to do some good. I always had that in me where I wanted to just do good. And I knew that I didn't know at what point or where, but I knew once I hit college and I started going into criminal justice that was going to be it. Eventually, I landed a job with the U.S. Border Patrol. And I was stationed in San Diego on the Southwest border for a number of years. Here it is. I'm a kid from the Bronx. I'm now in California, down in San Diego. It was totally different from what I ever imagined. Being on the U.S. border, it was an eye-opening experience, to say the least. But I remember I had a field training agent who said to me, hey, Ray, you have your degree? I said, yes, I do. And then he said, well, listen, DEA, FBI is hiring. I was happy doing what I was doing. I loved it. I was in great shape. I was running about 12 miles every night after people.
My goodness.
And but it was fun. And to me, it was important. So I started the background for DEA. And after about 2.5 years, I got hired. Immediately, I was placed in the New York Drug Enforcement Task Force, the oldest DEA task force in the world. And I worked alongside really super talented NYPD detectives and police investigators and agents that really took me under their wings and taught me how to investigate cases. They really kind of set the path for my career in DEA. Back in those days, we didn't really go home. I mean, we lived on the streets. We did surveillance for days on end, 24 hours a day. We would sleep in our cars. We would watch bad guys follow them. It was a different time, a different era. It was a lot of fun. I remember my first year on DEA, we seized about 7,000 kilograms of cocaine here in New York and New Jersey. We got very good at targeting organizations and how they move their drugs, the transportation means. And so what got me interested in, you know, Sinaloa cartel is because they controlled the market here in New York. Often, you know, we would arrest somebody here in New York and they would have phone numbers that they were calling back into, you know, the mountains of Durango or the mountains of Sinaloa. And quickly realized that Sinaloa cartel is the dominant cartel in the United States. From the early days when I first came on the job to today, they still are. Even with Chapo being convicted, Sinaloa cartel still plays a heavy role in what goes on in the United States.
Well, it's just interesting how things come full circle, right?
Sure, it really is. If you think about it, as technology developed and the organizations developed with it, they got stronger. They were able to move drugs not only in the United States. Sinaloa was able to move drugs throughout the world. They got more money and more powerful. And here it is, we're trying to pursue them. That's why I think it's really significant when you talk about, you know, this being full circle. This is long time coming. Mm-hmm. It's a long time coming getting Chapo. It's a long time coming convicting him. When you wrap this whole thing up, it goes back to all of us, agents, investigators, police, pursuing Sinaloa organization for many decades. This is a win for all of us.
It's a big win.
Sure.
And then another day.
And then another day. The fight continues. There are still other significant players in Mexico that we have to pursue. And there's the up-and-comers that are even more sophisticated than their fathers and their uncles. They're more tech savvy. They're more willing to take risks. And so, you know, we're aware of them and we're pursuing them too. Mm-hmm. We won't stop.
You have a win, but mm-hmm. then there's yet another person. There's yet another guy. There's another operation.
Sure.
How do you keep going and keep motivated?
What keeps me going is families. Ultimately, all the victims of the drug trade. And it's not only, you know, the people that use narcotics. It's going to be the family and friends of those individuals and some that have passed away and the communities that suffer because they became addicted to, you know, heroin. How can I do a better job of going after those bad guys? Because they don't care about the victims. They don't care about people dying. They care about money. They care about money and being able to do what they want. And my goal really is to save lives. Ultimately, that's what my plan is. Do a better job at doing that.
Congratulations to you, Ray. Thank you so much for being on Inside Crime and giving us your time. I know you're a busy guy. I hope you'll join us again sometime.
Thank you, Angeline.
And that's it for this episode of Inside Crime. Season 2 is coming up soon. If you haven't listened to all of Season 1, now's the perfect time to catch up. Go to our website, InsideCrime.com, to find out more about our podcast. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Angeline Hartman. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.